Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is True Crime Tuesday. How are you, Tim?
Doing very well.
Good to be back. Now, I know a couple weeks ago we promised that we were going to talk about the JonBenet Ramsey case, and unfortunately our guest had a family emergency that precluded him from joining us. He said as soon as his schedule would free up, he would join us and come back on to discuss his new book, Boulder Revisited, JonBenet. And he kept true to that promise. He's back with us now. For over two decades, the murder of JonBenet Ramsey has gone unsolved. What really happened in Boulder, Colorado in 1996? Well, Atlanta author Chad Spencer Keller is here to talk to us about his new book and some chilling updates in one of America's most infamous unsolved murder cases. Now over two decades old, the Boulder County District Attorney Office and the police department seem to have had very different views of what happened to JonBenet Ramsey. Where did they go wrong? Were prominent figures of the Boulder community, John and Patsy Ramsey, protected because of their status of wealth? And what about Burke Ramsey's possible role in his sister's death? Chad Spencer Keller is here to talk to us about this. Chad, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
It's a pleasure to catch up with you. You know, it's always hard to say that. We're going to talk about a brutal case. But, you know, this is something that's still, much like the OJ case, just grabs the attention of the world. They're fascinated to know what happened, why it may have happened, and any kind of new insight in this case. But let's start, if you wouldn't mind, at the beginning. And if you could give us a little bit of the background of this case and story and the players so that we can examine what happened and what we found out after, that'd be great.
Okay. As the world knows, JonBenet Ramsey has been unsolved for the past two decades. And, you know, we had a six-year-old little girl who was found murdered in her home. There was a ransom note that was written. 20 years later, there's a lot of questions. Now we have new forensic technology available, and there's just a lot of things that when you look back at the case, you know, what was available in 1996, you didn't have available then that you have available now. So it's interesting to go back and revisit everything. So when I started this journey, that's what I wanted to do, and it led me actually out into Boulder, Colorado.
Now, JonBenet Ramsey and the family, again, just to kind of set the stage, tell us about the family before the crime.
They were very wealthy family, very happy family. As far as what a family should be, I believe they were well educated, and the community they chose to live in, they had a house in Atlanta, Georgia, and then they had moved to Colorado when John Ramsey had started in with a new company. The Boulder setting to me, if you in the community they thrived in, there was a lot of things that people that are lower class are not privileged to. And I think them being in the upper class when this death happened to their daughter, that they were afforded protection that most American citizens aren't afforded.
Well, you know, there was a lot to be said at that time, you know, for these child pageants where, you know, people would deck up their children and parade them around. How old was JonBenet Ramsey when she began doing these type of pageants? Do you know?
I believe as early as three, if I'm not mistaken. It could have been a little earlier, but I mean, you know, it's disgusting in some way because you do have predators. You know, you do have your predators that will prey on children. Mothers, you know, they get together and they want to have the most beautiful daughter, and they want to parade them around, and they think it's all innocent and fun and something to do for mother-daughter time. But it can be dangerous for a small child to engage in, and it can get dangerous for the mother too, because there are numerous stalking stories with these pageants where people will not only stalk a child, but they will stalk the mother as well.
Well, that's creepy. Had they had any problems prior to this? Had JonBenet Ramsey or her mom, Patsy, had any kind of encounters, threats, or, ill will intent shown upon them?
Not really. I mean, they were well-to-do, prominent, figures in the community, and they were a well-liked family, which makes it more disturbing because, I mean, all you have to do is fake a smile if you're stalking somebody, you know?
Yeah, I guess you're right on that. Now, what type of business were Patsy and her husband in, aside from the pageant business with their daughter? What kind of work did they do for a living?
John was in, he was kind of in computer, a computer business, and Patsy, she was kind of the stay-at-home mom at the moment. She would do her mom side jobs, but as far as like the main breadwinner of the family, John Ramsey with his flourishing business, that was like where the majority of their income was coming in, and it was a very flourishing business. Computers in 1996, that was the profession to be in.
And did he make any enemies along the way that we've been able to uncover? I mean, I know there's a lot that's been said before and after the investigation, but did John Ramsey have issues with anybody that might want to hurt his daughter?
In my research, the Boulder Police Department and the district attorney did a very, very thorough search of people in his companies, and there wasn't really anybody that would go as far as to wanting to, murder JonBenet in his company. And you're looking at what's been considered a very violent kill, but if you're that mad at John Ramsey, why not kill John Ramsey and his wife and his son and his daughter, so to me, did he have enemies in his company? I didn't gather that through the research that the Boulder Police Department district attorney through their searches.
All right. And there was no real issues among other pageant moms, because there have been pageant moms out there and cheerleading moms who have created murder to elevate their child status in that realm. There was nothing at that point or any kind of threats or issues with other personalities that would lead us to believe that it might have been an enemy of the pageant circle.
Pageantry is a dog eat dog world, and that's the way the business goes. But the retrospect of the mothers and their children, I don't see anybody that would be hard up to kill, their daughter that was on the pageant circuits at this time that they were entering into. Not the contesting mothers and everybody, the competing competition. I don't see any reason for any of the other mothers to be so jealous to kill JonBenet Ramsey.
All right. Take us to December 24th, 25th of 1996, and talk to me a little bit about what we know was going on in JonBenet's life and her family's life that fateful night.
Well, on the 25th, Christmas Day, John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey had taken Bert, and Bert is the brother of JonBenet, the older brother. They went to the White's Christmas party. There's a lot of things happening before they left to go to this party in the home that in my book that I write about, I found to be very interesting with the situation prior to the Ramseys going to the White's Christmas party and leaving their own home that afternoon. you had JonBenet Ramsey, who had gotten a new bike for Christmas that morning. And John Ramsey was in the basement, and he was taking, that's where Patsy Ramsey had stored extra presents for the other Ramsey kids. They were flying out. They were going to be going to Disney World on the 26th the next morning. And their neighbor was a pilot, and John Ramsey was taking these extra gifts to load up on this airplane right before they went to the White House. And JonBenet Ramsey was actually in the basement, and this is in the wine cellar room at the time where these gifts were taken. And she's asking her dad if she can ride her bike longer. And he's like, no, no, we got to get ready to go. And she sees all these gifts in this room. And this is what I believe in my research to be very important for people who's followed the case for the past 2 years or two decades, or if you're new, it's important to pay attention what's going on around this time before they go to the party, just as much as when they come back from the party.
All right. Well, tell me about that. I mean, what was going on? Were they, you know, heading out for the night? Was there babysitters involved? Were they taking the kids with? What can you tell us?
Well, the kids went with them to the party. Okay. Then, you know, the Boulder community, it was just a real family oriented place. Yeah. A lot of people don't lock their doors in Boulder. Okay. Let's just say that. And you have a lot of get togethers, you know, you got your spirits, your parents drinking and everything, but kids were welcome. You know, I mean, the community, they were flourishing families and everybody had kids. So the kids went with the Ramseys to the White's Christmas party. It was a big event. So that's where they spend the majority of their evening into the late night with, that's how they did Christmas. And it was with the Whites, you know, that everybody had got together. And when they came back, when they come back at that night, it was around 10 o'clock PM, let's just say approximately in that time frame. This is where the story kind of goes awkward from the way the Ramseys tell the version of it. I find it incredible that just the events of John Ramsey, of how he states the form that Burke Ramsey was in later that night.
And what was that?
Burke had been playing with a train set, but John Ramsey also states that there was a garage set that Burke Ramsey was playing with that had stickers on it. And you put little stickers on this garage set. But the only problem with this garage set, if you look in the crime scene photos, actually, you can see a space garage Lego set. And it's leaned up against the wine cellar wall in several of the crime scene photos, and it's halfway opened. And my research, and this was like one of the strangest pieces of this whole case, the mystery, like surrounding this one Lego set, was kind of mind-boggling, because Burke Ramsey's birthday falls in January. And when Patsy Ramsey did the Christmas shopping earlier for Christmas, they went to FAO Schwartz in New York, and she had all the gifts pre-wrapped and mailed to the Boulder, Colorado home. So John Ramsey goes on record to state that Burke Ramsey was playing with this garage set, and it's the only gift that he got that was a garage set. But the thing is that this was his birthday present. This wasn't a Christmas present. So how does a Christmas present that wasn't a Christmas present but a birthday present get back into the wine cellar room and put back against the wall?
All right. And what have been the theories that have been bandied back and forth about this?
As far as theories go, if you go on Facebook, there's a huge, you have three basic main groups you have an intruder theory, you have the Burke Ramsey theory, and then you have the parents theory. And, a lot of people aren't really familiar with what the Space Lego garage set evidence is. It's kind of new in the book that I've been wanting to detail. I've had several discussions with people over Facebook and some of these groups, and these groups, man, they get 14,000, the 20,000 members in them. It's unbelievable, like the group size of these people, these sleuthers all out looking for the truth. But the one thing that people need to realize about this one specific gift is that JonBenet Ramsey, the morning of Christmas, all these presents are wrapped in FAO Schwartz wrapping paper, and she's handing out the gifts that morning. So one of my theories is, if Burke Ramsey was in the wine cellar that night or in the basement with JonBenet, it would be because she has seen this gift when she was asking her dad if she could go ride her bike, before they left to go to the White's Christmas party. And they come back home and she brings him downstairs because she knows there's more presents in the wine cellar room. Now if John Ramsey admits to seeing Burke Ramsey play with this toy, but he doesn't do the shopping, Patsy Ramsey would have been the person to put that toy back into the wine cellar room, because she would be the person to know that it was his birthday gift and not a Christmas present. So that would put JonBenet Ramsey taking Burke downstairs that night. And you have this Christmas present, and you have that's a birthday present. You have John Ramsey admitting that Burke Ramsey was playing with it, but it gets back into the wine cellar room.
All right. Well, let's talk about the three different possibilities, and let's start with the possibility of it being an intruder. What do we know, and what leads us to believe it would be an intruder? What makes us, kind of wipe away that scenario as a probability of it being an intruder? Let's talk about both sides of that coin.
Okay. The intruder theory is, it's fascinating because you have, there's a lot of people that theorize there's been an intruder. The only thing, a problem that I have grasping intruder, and it can't be ruled out, like, because anything's possible, but you also have to stay in the realm of logics. The Boulder Police Department, they investigated over 125 suspects that could have been intruders. And when you rule out over 125 people, you kind of need to start looking back inside the house to who we know was there that night. It's like the FBI agent, when they filed for the ransom note to say they called the police and they got the FBI out because their daughter was missing. The FBI agent said that you would find the daughter in the home or near the home, that she was not kidnapped. And that was kind of what had happened. It was just his research and his study as an agent that he could tell that the ransom note was kind of off, So as far as an intruder, you rule out 125 suspects, you kind of got to start looking back to the people we know were in the house.
Yeah, the intruder aspect there, there's so many inherent flaws with that story, which is sad, because as you said, that really then just kind of starts to point to something nefarious within the family that took place. Now let's talk about the mother and father and the possible scenarios involving them and the murder. Do we believe this was an accidental murder? Do we believe that this was a murder purposefully, you know, carried out? What could be said if we were to believe that the parents were involved?
If the parents were involved, they use the theory that JonBenet Ramsey had wet the bed and Patsy was just sick and tired of cleaning up after her. So, you know, she got mad one night and just snapped, and that's how JonBenet dies. But, you know, what? Why would the father help to cover up something like that if the mother violently attacked the daughter because of a bedwetting scenario? And the same thing with John Ramsey, if he was, fooling around with his daughter, fondling her, molesting her, and the mother found about it, why would the mother cover up for John Ramsey? So to me, for the parents to be involved, there would have to be a situation where both of them would be mad at JonBenet before a cover-up could take place, because they would both have to willingly be involved to kill their daughter. Because, I mean, if I was married to my wife and she killed one of my kids, I'm not going to cover up for it if it's a malicious, violent act, right, unless I'm involved in it. So as the parents being the murderer, you only get these theories of the bedwetting or John Ramsey molesting JonBenet, but you don't never have a theory of there being a combined reason for both parents to kill the daughter. And there really is nothing that you can come up with that would make them both mad at her. So in my research, if the parents were involved, it was more of a cover up for somebody else in the house, because I just don't see the parents being equally mad and covering up for one or the other.
All right. I can see that to a degree, but let's review the fact that, and at what point did it come out that they had a suicide pact, John and Patsy Ramsey?
Yeah, that was shortly after the murder, which they wanted to do a suicide pact, which, if my kid was supposedly kidnapped, which we find out they weren't kidnapped and weren't held for ransom, if there was an intruder, I mean, I'm going to be beating down doors and I'm going to be taking names and kicking some ass to find out who murdered my child. I'm not going to make a suicide pact when I have other living children. I thought that was very, very odd that they would do a suicide pact. It's one thing to grieve for your children, but when you get on an airplane and fly to Atlanta, during the investigation, and then next time you're being seen on TV, you got this suicide pact going on. Something's not registering right with the suicide,
That seems really weird though, right? That you would have the suicide pact in play if you weren't involved in some kind of cover up, some kind of shenanigans, with this case. Was there any financial gain in the death of JonBenet? Was there a hefty life insurance policy? Was their business failing? Was there anything behind the scenes that would lead us to look at, hey, they did have a reason to gain. They were irritated because of her bedwetting. They were irritated. Not that I'm giving credence to that being an okay reason, but I'm just trying to see if we can piece together a puzzle here that makes some kind of sense. Was there a financial gain in the death of JonBenet Ramsey?
Well, I mean, the business is flourishing. John Ramsey's business was flourishing. He had a $118,000 Christmas bonus for that year. And if you need any more money, you have two children. So why not kill both children and double the insurance policy? So you can kind of rule out, killing the daughter for an insurance gain, because if you got the opportunity to kill one child, why not kill both children and double your money,
Well, don't you think that would be just, again, playing in that kind of realm? If I you know, if we need to pay this, we need to make a sacrifice and choose, you know, something to go. Killing two is certainly going to turn the spotlight a lot harsher on us. If we take the pretty little girl who would certainly garner this kind of attention and would, you know, theoretically make more sense as Burke, really, there was, you know, he wouldn't have been somebody that would have pinged most people's radar. But you've got a beautiful little blonde girl who is sexied up. And I don't mean that in the ill intent that it sounds, but let's face it, you're dolling up these little kids, putting them in provocative outfits. So you're sexing her up. They're giving more of a purpose of this is why somebody would come in and murder this girl, right? For rape or molestation, and things go wrong, and then the death occurs. So there's that kind of aspect. I can understand that more than wiping out both, because then you really are kind of put underneath the gun.
Right. And also, there's a lot of theories with these pedophile rings, and the person that, you know, broke into the house to kill JonBenet was involved in a pedophile ring, which, you know, you pedophiles, if you have a ring, you know, there's a great opportunity that those people in that ring, they're going to like both little boys and girls. I mean, they're pedophiles, you know, I mean, it's just in their nature. So with the parents, you know, dolling up JonBenet Ramsey, I don't see it being premeditated in advance that they would have her killed in such a gruesome way just to gain, you know, financial circumstance. They're already wealthy. They really didn't need the money. So
nothing was ever uncovered about them being in any kind of financial hardship, or that the business might be getting ready to go under or fail.
Right. Not really at all. Because, okay. I mean, that business that John Ramsey was in, it was the time and place to be in computer software at that time, you know?
Right.
So it was very flourishing.
All right. So the criminal aspect doesn't seem plausible. The parents, although both seeming to do some really weird things, doesn't seem likely that they were the murderers. Now let's turn the camera around to Burke, who certainly has garnered a lot of attention lately with this multi-million-dollar lawsuit. I think it's CBS he's suing, because they did turn the spotlight on him to examine him as a potential person of interest in this murder case. Talk to me about Burke. What do we know about him before the murder? Is this a child that was socially maladjusted? Did he have any learning difficulties or issues?
Burke, to me, I would say is slightly on a spectrum of autism. I mean, that's just what I gathered. He's kind of socially awkward with people. Before JonBenet was found dead, there was an incident a year and a half before where Burke had hit JonBenet in the face with a golf club because he was jealous of her. Okay. And he did a pretty good damage to her and left a pretty nasty scar, you know, that's visible. If you look in some of JonBenet's photos, you can see it very well, even through makeup. Burke Ramsey, you know, I got to talk to a psychiatrist that was murdered execution style, like literally 13 days after I spoke with him. And he was one of the Ramsey psychiatrists at the time, you know, that this incident occurred. And, we'll get into, government misconduct portion later on, but it was just weird because I spoke 3 hours with this guy and I got his feel for, you know, Child Protective Services. And that was a brand new thing at that time, you know, that had been introduced. But he was subpoenaed to have his records with Burke Ramsey destroyed. They say that John and Patsy say that they let Burke Ramsey go with the whites, but actually he had been interviewed by this psychiatrist on the morning of the murder, and he was released to the whites after that, but it was kept off record. And, you know, I spoke 3 hours with this guy, and then he's murdered 13 days later, execution style. And he was going to be deposed in this, it's a $900 million civil suit. Burke Ramsey is suing CBS for $750 million. Then he's suing, you know, world-renowned pathologist Werner Spitz for another $150 million for showcasing a series that said that Burke Ramsey, you know, could have hit JonBenet Ramsey in the head with a flashlight, and that was a plausible scenario for death. Now, why Burke Ramsey would sue if you have all these world-renowned professionals that can, if you didn't do it, and their research will take you out of the theory lineup and remove you through their professional work, then why do you sue for $900 million?
I mean, there's a lot to be said, because he was not found guilty. Because there was no, there's no hard, true evidence. And by turning the spotlight on Burke, you know, as we've learned in the poll of public opinion, the minute you put out an allegation, whether it's true or not, it causes quite a mark on somebody's career. And right. If I were to come out and say, you know, there's probably a pretty good chance that Chad Keller's molested children, you'd be like, hold on. What the hell? Where do you have that to go on? Well, you keep talking about kids and you're doing a book on her. And I mean, it seems kind of interesting.
Right.
All of a sudden people start going, yeah, that is kind of weird, Chad. Why are you so fascinated about this? And I can see, you know, as an adult, it's got to be hard, A, to be the surviving son and surviving member of the Ramsey family, B, to have that albatross around your neck, and then C, to have somebody point the finger of doubt in your direction. And now there's nobody else there to side with you. There's a bunch of things that actually kind of make it look like you. If he is truly innocent, that ruins his life and his ability to make a financial place in his world. Because who the hell is going to hire somebody who's a potential murderer? You know, I mean, I know there are some people, but do you want to work for $15 an hour for the rest of your life because of that stigma? So I can understand a lawsuit in that if he truly is innocent.
Well, I get the where you're coming from on that aspect, but still, you know, I mean, it's a theory. It will eventually debunk itself if you have the greatest experts in like modern time working on it. I mean, Burke Ramsey out.
Hold on a second. O.J. Simpson had the greatest defense attorneys in the world, but nobody believes that O.J. is innocent. Right. So there is that case. Just because you have the greatest experts on your side does not necessarily mean that that's going to get everybody to swing. Yeah, that it's going to swing the public opinion poll off of you. So I get that, and I mean, let's face it. He's certainly going to remain a person of interest in a lot of people's minds. And that judgment has already been made on a lot of half truths and misunderstandings.
Right. And that's been long before CBS aired this series also. I mean, if you go to Boulder, Colorado, everybody, like, there's 98.5% of the town that I was interviewing and having discussion with, they believe Burke Ramsey, you know, was the culprit in this ordeal. And it's just amazing that, you know, that it's a hush thing in the community, but people believe that it's Burke Ramsey, and they believe that it was Burke Ramsey back in the mid-90s when it happened, and still believe to this day, way before this CBS series ever came out, you know. And you have you brought up a thing of innocent. Colorado has a state law where to even be charged with negligent homicide, you have to be 10 years of age or older to even be charged with negligent homicide, even if the death was accidental and the parents covered it up. So Burke Ramsey, he was 9 years old at the time. So even if this was an accident, he still cannot be charged with any portion of the crime because he was 9 years old at the time. So that's another thing that Burke Ramsey has in his defense if he was responsible for this death, that he was 9 years old. He couldn't even be charged for it.
Right, but that doesn't release or relinquish public opinion. Okay, yeah, you were only 9 years old. You made a bad choice, but I don't want to hire him. He's a killer. If he was willing to kill his sister, what else is he willing to do if you piss him off? You know, that's going to kind of be the undercurrent.
Right, and that's also the thing with like all these intruders, people, you know, Patsy Ramsey blamed Wolf for the longest time for being, you know, she wrote the book on it that Wolf was the intruder suspect. Where's their $900 million civil suit? Because their lives are being damaged as well, you know, like everybody who's supposed to be an intruder. I mean, their lives have been tarnished just as well as Burt's. And that goes back to the spectrum of your three possible whodunit, you know, suspects.
Right.
You had an intruder.
But have their lives, if you review it, have their lives truly been impacted? Have we seen them gone from, you know, upper class to middle class or lower class in their financial status because of those allegations, or because nothing came of them and the law never said that? The law never found them guilty or really never investigated them fully. You know, did it not have a long lasting impact? You know, it's easier once you're an established person than it is for a kid who's coming up and has this spotlight of speculation shining on them so strongly. It would make, I would think, life a lot harder going forward for that person who has nothing than for people who are already established.
Right. And that's like Wolf wasn't a highly established person, but he spent every last dime he could on attorneys to fight the allegations of him being the intruder for so many years. You know, when Patsy Ramsey's book came out, and people, I mean, they destroyed his life, and he didn't have nothing to begin with you know?
Talk to me about her story and kind of putting that light out there. Why did she believe that he was the culprit?
I think that she just needed to put direction somewhere else. I mean, my honest opinion, I read the book. There's nothing, not even DNA, you know, ties Wolf to being the intruder. So I believe at the time it was, you know, that they hit a financial downfall economically. The Ramseys did financially. They went broke, you know, during this time period. So I think the book was to you know, secure financial gain to for them financially, but also to just get out under the spotlight and the stress for the moment. You publish the book, you put the blame on a person other than anybody in the Ramsey home that was part of JonBenet's family, and that's what I believe the book was for, was to take you know, the spotlight off of them being the suspects for the moment, and to kind of just get some financial capital flowing back into the family.
So that was it. You think that in that sense, it was purely capital gain and they had no worry about who they were destroying to get there.
Right.
What is this video? And I only saw it in a glance, but I've never actually seen the full video. Is it Burke that they're talking to? And he mentioned something about hitting his sister with a hammer.
Yes, it's Burke. And he's being questioned, you know, by one of the psychologists, children psychologists. And they're asking, well, what do you think happened? At first, he states that, someone went like bam, bam with a knife. Okay, and they did find Burt Ramsey's pocket knife at the scene of the incident, which is kind of, you know, astonishing. And then they say, well, how do you think this happened? And he goes, maybe with a hammer or something. Someone just went like, and he throws his body over the table. You know, he throws his arm forward in a swinging motion, and he says, bam, bam, like that. And it's like just so disturbing. And you know, with the CBS series, if you had a chance to watch the CBS series, they do a reenactment with a 9-year-old kid hitting a fake skull, you know, with a flashlight, and it recreates almost an identical fracture that JonBenet Ramsey suffered. And it's just amazing that Burke at his age, you know, he would have knowledge of how he thinks she was dead. And none of this was released in the news to him at the time, you know? So this, it was like an innocent opinion of a child, and he's given a scenario of her getting hit in the head, and he doesn't have this knowledge at all.
Now, how old was Burke at that time?
Burke was 9. Burke was 9 years of age.
He was 9 years of age. Yep. And was he showing any kind of sadness, loss for the death of his sister?
There was no empathy. The child psychiatrist asked him to draw a family portrait, and JonBenet was left out of the drawing. And if you go and look at footage of the day that JonBenet was buried, Burke is smiling throughout the funeral procession. Now I don't take that as a sinister child. I attribute some of that to some of the emotional, his autism, his social awkwardness, So I can't really say that he's a sinister child, but there is something that's not right. He lacks total empathy. He goes on Dr. Phil, and Dr. Phil asks him, you know, did he murder his sister? And he's like, no. And he has like these long pauses, and he's just socially awkward. But the thing that he didn't do, you see a lot of these murder shows, and even like 10, 20 years later, the siblings who want revenge for their murdered sibling, they get on these shows and they're hell bent to kill and find or deliver justice any way possible. And Burke was lacking that motivation for vengeance or even empathy to distinguish that his sister was dead. And then, 20 years later, there's no looking for her.
Well, the police initially suspected, right, that you said the ransom note was written possibly by Patsy Ramsey, and that the note,
correct,
and kind of the staging of the body looked very fake in order to cover up a crime. But in 1998, the district attorney said that due to new DNA analysis, none of the immediate family members were under suspicion for the crime. And then in 98, the police and the DA both said that JonBenet's brother Burke, who was 9 years old, as we mentioned at the time of that death, was also ruled out as a suspect. So what was the DNA telling us? Was there any specific information they could give us? Was it a white man, black man, Asian? Was it, old, young? Was there any kind of DNA that they were able to pull from this that would give us any kind of profile of the killer that we might be looking for? Or was it the lack of DNA that existed that would keep us from believing that it was anyone of the family?
Well, see, the DNA is a very touchy subject. JonBenet's body was moved 4 times, in the household. So you have what's called touch DNA, where say, there were people upstairs all morning long because the Ramseys had called over all their friends to the house. Now, if JonBenet Ramsey is laying in the basement and John Ramsey runs down there and picks her up and brings her back up, you're standing upstairs, 5 minutes before he goes downstairs, and you sneeze on the floor or just in the house. If you sneeze and it happens to be the place that John Ramsey brings back JonBenet to and lays her on the floor, then your DNA has just contaminated that body. Okay. I mean, it touch DNA is so sensitive. I mean, so the DNA profiles, they were able to assess it was a Caucasian male. And this is, this was in 1996, 97, 98, when they're and the forensic technology never really started booming until 2003 with what they could do with testing DNA. So to me, Alex Hunter, the district attorney, he was in charge of all the evidence, and I believe a lot of the DNA stipulation, I believe it was manipulated. I believe a lot of the testing was manipulated, because they ruled out the Ramseys, but then in new testings, you do have the mother's DNA, you do have the father's DNA around, and that's because, you know, they washed clothes, they folded the clothes, they moved their body. So there was actually DNA from John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey on JonBenet, because Patsy's holding her, and John went down to the basement to pick him up. So in 98, when they're releasing these statements that the Ramsey family was clear DNA, that's false, because with touch DNA and how sensitive it is, we know that John and Patsy's DNA did transfer to JonBenet.
And here's the weird part too, right? I mean, first of all, she calls her friends and family. She calls the police. They come over. You've got, Officer French, who actually went down to the basement, came to the door that was secured by the wooden latch, and he thought about it, but didn't end up opening that door. I mean, which is a critical error. You're looking for a missing child, and you don't open a door that's latched. And right on the other side of that door is JonBenet's body. So they end up making these arrangements to pay this ransom. And, you know, because the team, I guess, eventually they did believe that she might have been kidnapped. But then they only cordon off JonBenet's room to prevent contamination. So there seems to be a lot of really bad police work going on throughout this case.
Right. And the police work, you know, it was Christmas time. So you had the part-time staff workers pretty much working, you know, like all the major investigators didn't come to the scene till later. When Linda Arndt arrives, you know, onto the scene, she wasn't specifically your number one investigator, you know, and detective you want to send out to a murder. And at the time, it wasn't a murder. It was a missing child, you know, call. And that's why the FBI got involved, because of the ransom note. So, yeah, you have JonBenet in the house, and you have a lot of mistakes made by the Boulder Police Department because they didn't have their A-team workers involved in it, right, because of the holiday season.
Just so people understand too, the other problem is she called her friends, family, and I think even the minister had come over, and they were all trying to keep her company. So first of all, you've got this huge group of people in there contaminating, and not only are they contaminating, right, but to help her, they're tidying up around the house, wiping things down, cleaning, cooking, doing things to help aid the family while they're waiting. And that's, again, a mistake that was made, and you'd think would have been something the police would have stopped. Hey, we can't have anybody go in and out of this house until we've, you know, cleared and we've collected evidence. But again, this was the police work of the time. What we see on TV, you know, CSI, NCIS, all of, you know, Law and Order. Unfortunately, that's not the way cases really work in some ways, especially in places like Boulder, Colorado, where murder rates are probably not that high. And they don't have as much experience dealing with these type of cases.
Right. Yeah. But Boulder is a tight knit little family community. And, you know, you got to kind of go outside of Boulder into Denver, Colorado, and Colorado Springs, where all your murders are happening. And they're equipped, you know, to take on larger cases. But yeah, with Patsy Ramsey calling these people, and she called her friends before she called the police, which has always, you know, been another mind-boggling thing. Your daughter's been kidnapped, and you're going to call up all these people to come over, you know, and then call the police, which there allows for the contamination. You know, you had a lot of people walking around that house all day long, you know.
Well, now, on the other side of things, and just kind of playing the devil's advocate here, the alleged ransom note said not to call the police.
Right. So will behead your daughter.
Right. So I would say, you know, in that case, as a parent, I might call my friends and I don't know what to do. What do I do? I can see that aspect of it, you know, and not making the first call to the police, because if there's a chance I can get my daughter back, what do I do? Who do I know that would have a good head on their shoulders? I'm too close to this. So I can see making that call to my brother or my oldest son and saying, I don't know what to do. What do I do? You know, and looking for some kind of outside influence and insight, somebody that could take me out of the fog I'm in that my child is missing and perhaps kidnapped.
Right. And then if we look back on the other side of the coin, Sina Wong, who was a handwriting analysis, she found 250 similarities and consistencies in the ransom note that matched Patsy Ramsey's handwriting. Patsy Ramsey was ambidextrous. So she did write left-handed. And the ransom note, it was wrote left-handed. You find 250 consistencies in it. So to me, the ransom note, you know, the district attorney excluded Sina Wong's research from going in to, you know, into being admissible for the grand jury to review. Now, if you're trying to discover who could have been possible for writing this ransom note and murdering this little girl, why do you exclude the ransom note with 250 similarities from the parent, you know? So whether she called the friends because she's afraid of the police coming, the bottom line is she still called the police. You know, and the note said, we're watching, we will behead your daughter if you call the police. And she called the police immediately after. So there's a tell all sign there that she wasn't necessarily afraid of her daughter dying, that, you know, because she still broke the rules of the ransom note and called the police.
All right. So with all of this information that's already kind of been laid out there, what new information has really broken? What new aspects of this case is there to reveal at this point?
The new evidence, you know, to me that there is, and it might be considered circumstantial as far as DNA evidence. The DNA evidence in this case is so tampered with that they're not going to be able to ever really find a breakthrough with DNA just because of the contamination. The evidence in the wine cellar room with Burke Ramsey's gift, his birthday gift, to me, that's pretty compelling evidence because it puts Burke Ramsey and JonBenet in the wine cellar, and it puts John Ramsey on record stating that Burke was playing with the gift. And, you know, Patsy Ramsey purchased the gift and knew it was his birthday present. John Ramsey didn't. So it would end up from where John Ramsey saw Burke playing with it back into the wine cellar. Because if you're the parents and you're covering up, Patsy Ramsey psychologically would say, oh, no, this is Burke Ramsey's birthday gift. I got to get this back in the wine cellar. So that's how that gift would go from where John Ramsey saw Burke playing with it to get back to the wine cellar. But it puts Burke Ramsey down in the basement with JonBenet when they come back from the White's Christmas party. I mean, you know, because it's just logical sense to me of why we have a birthday present opened up and it's in the wine cellar, but why JonBenet or John Ramsey thought it was a Christmas present that Burke was playing with. But it wasn't his Christmas present. It was his birthday gift. So when you put those pieces of the puzzle together, you know, and you rule out 125 people on the intruder, to me, it puts Burke Ramsey down in the basement. But a lot of the other things to follow would be with what I consider government misconduct. And when you add that up, that's a lot of the evidence to the puzzle also is the government misconduct in the case.
Now, You were talking about DNA and how flawed it was. And in December 2003, right, they had those forensic investigators. They were able to extract enough material from a mixed blood sample found on JonBenet's underwear that they could establish a DNA profile, and that belonged to an unknown male person. They, if I remember correctly, too, they kind of submitted that to the FBI combined DNA index. And, you know, I know there's like 1.5 million people in DNA profiles through there, but it didn't match anybody. They re-evaluated it in 2016 and found out through the original DNA that it contained genetic markers from two individuals other than JonBenet. So was she sexually assaulted as well?
You know, that's a good question, because depending on if you have an expert from the, you got to realize that, you know, District Attorney Alex Hunter said, do not treat the Ramseys as suspects, treat them as prominent figures of the community. And that was an order. So depending on experts from, you know, which, if you're coming from the Boulder Police Department, or if you're coming from the private Ramseys investigator, or if you're coming from the district attorney's office, the science community, you have no positive confirmation that she was sexually assaulted, but you have what is called professional opinion. Okay. And some of the people that say she's sexually assaulted, the other experts will say that this activity is common in people that were active as JonBenet in that age. So that's one of the biggest misconceptions of one of this entire case that I find fascinating, is that the district attorney would sell the sexual assault as if it was 100% proven, which it has never been proven. Okay. They can only give professional opinions as to she could have been possibly sexually assaulted, but there is no confirmation. No expert on any side has ever gave a positive confirmation 100% that she's been sexually assaulted. And you had the paintbrush, the handle that was broken, and we have JonBenet undressed and redressed, and they found a nano micro piece of wood from the paintbrush inside of her, which, you know, some experts say that she was sexually assaulted with this broken paintbrush handle, but it is so small you couldn't even see it with the naked eye, and they claim that it could have caused you know, irritation, just this little piece of wood. But the thing with that is it could have also been transferred, because touch DNA is so sensitive when they undressed her in the area. If she wet her pants and, you know, used the bathroom all over herself during this crime, and, you know, if say Patsy Ramsey or John Ramsey changed her, you know, out of her clothes into something else, that piece of wood could have easily been transferred during the changing of clothes. Is that's how sensitive DNA is, you know. So as far as the sexual assault, never by any expert is it proven. It's only a professional opinion to some.
All right. Is there anything else that's been uncovered that would lead you down one path or another? I mean, if it were up to you today and you had to make a declaration, you were the judge, jury, and executioner in this case, who do you believe murdered JonBenet Ramsey?
I believe that JonBenet Ramsey's death was more accidental, and it was caused by the brother. And I believe that the parents did cover up. And I believe that the parents covered up just because they're the actions of the district attorney's office to follow. And again, as far as crucifying Burke Ramsey for murder, he was under the age of 10. He can be publicly, you know, crucified, but as far as actually filing charges on him, let's say if Burke Ramsey did do the deed, and the parents covered up. Patsy Ramsey has died and passed away. John Ramsey's still alive. He could be, they could possibly bring back charges for accessory to a crime on John Ramsey. And, you know, but all you have to do is plead temporary insanity, you know, but the case is,
well, that's not as simple. I mean, you plead temporary insanity. You've had 20 plus years since to come forward and make it right. Yeah. So I doubt that would hold any water.
But as far as Penn and Burke with the actual murder lawfully, he was 9 years old when it occurred. So by Colorado state law, he would be protected under that sense. And I believe that's why I believe that, you know, there's a lot of money transactions going on with the Ramseys directly to district attorney Alex Hunter. And I believe that they afforded their safety and their protection from a prosecution. And because Burke Ramsey was 9 years old, I believe, you know, that, you know, you got district attorney Alex Hunter lying about that there's no evidence to go forward with the indictments. They were indicted by the grand jury for accessory to murder, and it was hidden on live TV. You know, I mean, who the hell does that? You know, you got the grand jury pushing for it, but the district attorney doesn't prosecute. And you also had John Ramsey meeting with Alex Hunter behind closed doors. And his attorney, Ramsey's attorneys, they were the, a lot of people might find this new, I don't know, but the attorneys for the Ramseys were the former district attorneys of Boulder County. So they would have trained and they would know Alex Hunter very well. So if you get your attorneys who are former district attorneys and they're meeting behind closed doors with Alex Hunter and the Ramseys are all of a sudden going broke, you know, I mean, there's something going wrong there that I can consider government misconduct.
Well, here's the other thing. I don't think it's cut and dry that if Burke came out and admitted it now, there's nothing that could be done because he's impeded an open case for 20 plus years. So although he may not be found quote unquote guilty of his sister's murder, there would
be charged with other charges.
Right. There'd be a lot of charges. So this kid is, you know, he's not in for a cut and dry case. He would be. Now, here's what I think is interesting. OK, by opening this type of lawsuit and defamation of character, he himself is opening himself up to be investigated and to be re-questioned. This is similar to what happened in the West Memphis 3 case when Terry Hobbs lodged the lawsuit against Natalie Maines. That was actually the best thing in the world for the law enforcement officials that wanted to examine Terry Hobbs before but didn't have probable cause. Now they had a reason to ask questions. Now they had a reason to probe deeper into this. So I'm sure that whatever attorney Burke would have, you know, forewarned him that, hey, by doing this, you're opening yourself up for a line of investigation again and re-examination. And so, you know, to me, in one sense, you know, is it that he really feels that he's been diminished and will never have a fulfilled life? So get your money. And he's just that greedy. Or is he innocent and, you know, and going for this because of what's happened to him and the kind of cross he's had to bear throughout his life? It'll be interesting to see how this case unfolds and plays out. But, you know, if I were the prosecuting attorney, I would crucify the remaining Ramseys for everything that we've chatted about here, you know, for hiding and, you know, of course, John Ramsey and helping to hide this information. And I guess at this point, it'd be also conspiracy to murder. They could get this guy on many different cases because he's hidden it for so long and worked along with Patsy and Burke and probably other people to keep this story under wraps. I'm not fully sure that I believe that it was an inside job yet. I'm still intrigued, and certainly you've unveiled quite a few new things to tickle the medulla oblongata and keep me thinking. But I still, as a parent, I have a hard time grabbing some of the concepts that parents would be involved in this. And I know some of the stories have been, well, your son accidentally murders your daughter, So you've already lost your daughter. If you turn in your son, now you have a chance of losing your son and your daughter, and no family's prepared for that. Listen, if one of my children murdered another one of my children, I wouldn't cover for them. I wouldn't protect them because it took the life of someone else I loved, and they would need to pay the ultimate penalty and price for doing such a thing. And if that makes me a bad dad, then I'll be a bad dad gratefully, because there's no way I would allow somebody to get away with murder.
Right, right. That makes sense. And you also have to look at the entitlement that the Ramseys had socially in their community. If you turn in your child, you know, maybe to them it was easier to pretend JonBenet Ramsey got kidnapped in the beginning instead of turning in Burke Ramsey. I mean, Burke Ramsey's 9 years old, so yeah, you're going to lose him as a ward to the custody of the state, you know, at least until he's psychologically evaluated. You know, if he did accidentally kill his sister, and before they could determine it a homicide or whatever. But you also got to look at the control factors of the Ramseys. They were, you know, if you review their nature, they were borderline control freaks, and their feel for their establishment in the community, it kind of empowered them, you know. So I could see them creating things to protect Burke and lying and covering up just to forego the embarrassment, you know, to not to deal with it, to that their family is not the perfect family that they portrayed themselves to be, you know.
Very strange. Boulder Revisited, JonBenet. Chad Keller, thank you so much for stopping by and filling us in on the story and sharing some of the new insights. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me on today. Maybe we'll chat again pretty soon.
Yep, please keep us in the loop. And if you find out more information, keep us updated on that as well. All right, it's time to lighten the mood a little bit here after child murder and all of the ickiness of this. Let's take a good long look at dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. The case files are open.
All right.
To rock and or roll. And we've got a lot of great stories, Tim. Since we had so much fun with dumb burglar monikers.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd start off with one. It's a very short story, literally a very short story. The search for the Loose Pants Bandit is taking place right now in Philadelphia, Tim.
The Loose Pants Bandit.
I might have gone with the Baggy Pants Bandit, just to give that alliteration feel to it.
Uh-huh.
The Loose Pants Bandit is on the loose. Philadelphia police and the FBI are looking for a suspect whose pants were falling down when he robbed the M&T Bank on the 6500 block of Castor Avenue. The holdup happened Thursday at 2:15 p.m. in Northeast Philadelphia. No one was hurt.
Well, thank God for
that. I feel
like
that's not much to go on. The man we're looking for has loose pants. They may be seen somewhere below his belt line. I don't know that that's really enough to get anybody arrested, do you think?
No.
Tim, we've got a big story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love when we can mix celebrities and true crime.
Right.
Boy Meets World actor William Daniels, also known as the voice of Kit from the hit TV series. I almost said the tit TV series.
Yes.
From the hit TV series Knight Rider, Tim,
mm-hmm.
foiled a robbery attempt. Of course he would. He's Kit and Mr. Feeny. William Daniels spoke to ABC after word got out that the Boy Meets World actor foiled a burglary attempt on his Los Angeles home. We were asleep, and I heard bang, 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 Daniels on the phone with wife Bonnie Bartlett said. I lit the light, and Bonnie screamed, and this person fled. Well, I think you scared him away, Bartlett added. Yes, I did. That's what the actor said, and then posted on Twitter Tuesday. He was responding to a report from ABC7's Eyewitness News about his sitcom star, Will Friedle. I'm sorry, he said, Boy Meets World actor Will Friedle knows all too well you don't mess with Mr. Feeney. That's what he posted on Twitter. William Daniels, the actor behind George Feeney thwarting a home robbery attempt, a rep for Daniels, 91, confirmed to EW in a statement that he was at home with wife Bonnie Bartlett in California's San Fernando Valley on Saturday night when a potential intruder tried to break in. According to ABC7, the individual forced open the back door but ran off when Daniels turned on the lights. Luckily, Mr. Daniels was able to frighten away the person, and the LAPD quickly responded. His publicist said, They're both well. Mr. Daniels thanks all of his fans for their concern. Friedle, who played Feeney's pesky next-door neighbor, Eric Matthews, reacted on social media shortly after the news came to light. Don't ever mess with Mr. Feeney. Love you, Bill and Bonnie. That was his little Twitter message to him.
Aw.
Now, do you think this? Okay, he scared him off.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the news. Now, this criminal that got away realizes that the guy that he got away from was 91. Do you think maybe that pings his radar to go back and try it again? Because now he knows he's just up against a 91-year-old?
I would think it would, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe this isn't something that should have made the news.
Yeah.
I don't know in that sense. But why are they playing up the fact that he was Mr. Feeney and not Kit?
Oh,
Kit was a little bit more badass. I'm just saying.
I think maybe because Mr. Feeney was in front of the camera.
Yeah, but I would feel like it's more of a challenge, truthfully, to go back up against Mr. Feeney than it would be that, oh my God, I broke into the house of Kit, the talking car. I'm not going back. He's got lasers and missiles and junk. I don't know. I could be wrong. Is a ghost named Bill in the Indian River County Jail, Tim? That's the question this article asks. Everyone's heard of Casper, the friendly ghost, but how about a ghost named Bill? A 46-year-old Indian River County jail inmate on October 7th reported to investigators that a ghost named Bill told him to swing a broom at a television to get out of jail, an affidavit states. Vincent Foggy is accused of taking a long-handled broom and hitting a flat-screen television in the jail, damaging the TV. Security footage shows Foggy swinging the broom at a flat-screen TV valued at about $300. Foggy said to deputies, he was told by a ghost named Bill to swing the broom at the television in order to get out of jail, the affidavit says. Rather than being freed from incarceration, Foggy was arrested on criminal mischief charge in connection with the alleged TV bashing. Again, alleged seems like a superfluous word at this point. We have videotape of him hitting said TV with a broom. It's no longer alleged that he did it. He damn well did it, Tim.
Yeah.
It wasn't immediately clear whether a ghost named Bill shares any criminal liability.
I doubt it.
Foggy had been in jail following a number of arrests, including an alleged sex offender registration-related violation. Maybe Bill, the ghost, should have just said, hey, stop diddling kids. That's how you get out of jail. Do you think?
I think so. You know, here's the thing. I mean, do you really even need more jail time for the guy? Because all you need to do is put him right in the middle of the population. He took a swing at the only means of outside, somewhat simulated freedom you have, which is the television. Ooh. So wouldn't the population just take care of him if you took a broom to the valued TV in the room?
I would think so. Yeah, all the guards turn their back for a few minutes,
yeah,
and drop a couple of ice picks,
yep,
you know, which we all carry in our pockets, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
A shiv?
Yeah, a shiv.
Yeah.
Sharpened piece of metal. Why not?
Police, a man is wanted for stealing from an adult store, Tim. State police said they're looking for a man who stole $100 worth of merchandise from an adult store.
Wonder what he got hold of.
They said the theft happened on October 21st around 4 p.m. at the Easy Adult Playtime Boutique in Worth Township. They've released a photo of the man they said was observed stealing items. They're asking anyone with information to call PSP Rockview at 814-355-7545. That's 814-355-7545. The picture, Tim?
Mm-hmm.
Could be anyone. He's wearing a black knit stocking cap.
Mm-hmm.
CCTV has really come a long way unless you're wearing a hat of any type.
Oh, sure.
And then you just look like every other schmuck. But if you happen to know the guy who stole $100 worth of merchandise, I'm guessing anal beads, heating lube, and I don't know, maybe a DVD, Tim.
Maybe a DVD?
Maybe. That's all. I would think he got out of there with $100 worth. Those are all stuff you could stick in your pockets. Well, at least that's stuff I've watched you stick in your pockets. What? So I'm going to guess. Huh?
How do you know? What?
What?
I've never stuck that
son
stuff
of
in
a
my
what?
Pockets.
Sam, you just walked out with it?
No.
Is that what you're trying to say?
No. I've never been to the Easy Pleasure Shack or wherever that place is.
Poop or treat, Tim?
I'll take the treat, please.
Police in St. Johnsbury said they've wrapped up their investigation into a Halloween caper. They tell WCAX News that when a child got a bag of poop, it wasn't a trick or a treat. It was an accident.
Oh, sure.
Wednesday night, city police told us they investigated more than one case. Thursday, they corrected that and said it was only one case on Mount Pleasant Extension. Chief Timothy Page said he didn't know how the poop got wrapped up and put in the kid's Halloween bag, but he does confirm there will be no further investigation into it.
You.
How do you accidentally wrap up poop and put it in somebody's Halloween bag? That seems like a choice.
Yeah.
Unless you want to save the kid's morale and, you know, not really. It's bullying if it was one kid that was singled out. Maybe you don't want that kid to feel singled out. So you say, oh, no, it was just an accident.
I don't know. I don't get how that's even an accident. Yeah.
My uncle used to heat up pennies and drop them into the plastic bag to melt a hole through the bottom of the bag.
Aww.
Yeah. Uncle Bob, shame on you.
Jeez.
You know the old saying, Tim, they took everything and didn't even leave me a pot to piss in?
Yeah.
Well, a toilet was stolen from a Huntington home. This is one of those rare cases where it legitimately took everything, including the pot to piss in. It's often said that thieves will take whatever they can get their hands on, but one burglary case in Huntington has truly left the victims and neighbors dumbfounded. Saturday, Barry Heider went to his daughter's wedding. One of the happiest moments of his life was followed by one of the most bizarre when he returned home. Our back door was wide open, Heider said. Somebody had climbed through a window into his house along Monroe Avenue in Huntington. The place was ransacked, Heider said. Heider says there's been a leak in his bathroom, so he'd been planning to remodel it and install a brand new commode, which was sitting in a box in his living room. The thief stole a TV, computer, and the new toilet. How desperate are you that you steal a toilet of all things, Heider said. Neighbors are confused why a thief would stoop to this new low. I don't understand why somebody would steal a toilet, neighbor Ashley Holland said. It's very sad for somebody to break into somebody's house just to steal a toilet. Well, they didn't. They stole TVs and computers.
Yeah.
The toilet was just a bonus find. That was like walking along in a video game and you're like, oh, you see a gun. Will you pick it up? Yes. Ah, there's ammunition. Will you pick it up? Yes. Oh, how about the elixir of life? Yes, I'll take the elixir of life. Yes, I'll take a brand new unwrapped commode. Why would they steal it? Because they're expensive. People steal packs of gum and you have a hard time understanding why somebody would steal your unbound toilet. It's fitting you stole a toilet because this is a bunch of crap, the owner said. Heider moved to Huntington last November and said this is the third time there's been a break-in at his home in less than a year. He says this toilet theft is the last straw. He's making plans to move to Tennessee to be with relatives. This is it, he said. I can't handle anymore. Do you have to disclose that your house has been broken into three times in 1 year when you're selling a house?
No.
Huh.
It's probably bad for the market.
Yeah. Four women in Steelton are facing charges after an officer on patrol saw two toddlers running across the street. One of the toddlers, according to police, was toting a beer. The officer was on patrol October 7th in the area of South 4th Street when he saw two children under the age of two running across the street. Both children didn't have shoes on. One was carrying a full opened bottle of beer, police said.
That's a rough neighborhood.
Babies? Who's his baby's kids, Tim, or what?
That's a rough neighborhood right there.
As a result of the investigation, the following women are charged with endangering the welfare of children. Ashley Harcum, 29, Teresa Rockingberg, 52, Rebecca Rockingberg, 27, and Akiba Johnson, age 24. Kid running around with under 2 years old, running around with an open bottle of beer.
At least he didn't have a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. I mean, you know, that.
I guess.
You're
always that silver linings kind of guy.
You don't want two vices at the same time. You start them out slow.
Oh, my goodness. What is this? Oh, Tim, in the news, Spider-Man is back. Not once, but twice.
Ooh.
How often is that? It's really weird how stories clump like this, right?
Yeah.
Alain Robert, known as the French Spider-Man, has been banned from climbing buildings in Britain after his Thursday arrest for illegally scaling one of London's tallest towers without ropes, Tim.
Hmm.
Robert, a 56-year-old grandfather, grandpère, as we say in France, Tim, appeared in magistrate court in London on Friday, where he pleaded guilty to causing a public nuisance. He received a 20-week suspended sentence and a $7,000 fine and was barred from climbing all buildings in Britain until further notice. So I ask you this, my friend, will there be a time when the British government says, we need a building climbed, it is time to bring out the French Spider-Man once more?
Probably not.
Until further notice. All right, we're lifting the ban. Anyone can climb buildings at any time. You are demonstrably an accomplished climber, but there is always a danger that your actions could be imitated by those less proficient, with potentially fatal consequences. That's what Chairman of the Bench Edward McMullen said. I said that with French. It should have been McMullen's, more of kind of an Irish thing, isn't it?
Well, he's in Britain, so I...
Yeah. Oh, you're demonstrably an accomplished climber, but there's always the danger that your actions could be imitated by those less proficient, with potentially fatal consequences.
So he sounds like Commissioner Gordon from the 1966 Batman series.
Of course, that's the only Irish accent I know.
I see. Huh.
Prosecutor said Robert appeared to, or Robert, I don't know, it says Robert, but I'm going to give it the French twist, Tim.
Yeah.
Which you have to pay extra for in Las Vegas.
You do.
Yeah. Prosecutor said Robert appeared to have been sponsored to do the climb, as he was wearing a T-shirt bearing a company logo, Sky News reported. The company logo, of course, Beyond the Darkness. Yeah. It was well worth the $72 we gave him, Tim.
Yeah.
Robert took an hour to climb the 46-floor, 755-foot-tall Huron Tower. He immediately handed waiting police officers his passport, the number for his lawyer, and was then arrested. He decided to scale the building after seeing photos of the skyscraper 2 days before. He told the network his goal was climbing is to get to the top and to stay alive. When you're climbing, as I'm not using any safety devices, when life is at stake, I guarantee that you are focused, Robert said. He said the climb seemed doable. I would guess so if you did it.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
His lawyer, Adelia Khan, said her client had no intention or foresight of the disruption he caused. He's been climbing for 44 years and is an extremely experienced climber. One of the best in the world, she said. He has won awards for the sort of climbing. Is there really a building award commission, Tim?
Hello, my French countrymen. Today we are going to award for the best building climber in the country. Mr. Alain Robert.
Are there a lot of them up for that award, though, Tim?
I would say no, Dave. No, he's probably the only one. Yeah.
Robert has scaled dozens of skyscrapers over the years, including the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, in 97, though he was apprehended before reaching the top. He's also climbed the Willis Tower in Chicago, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, and the New York Times building.
Hmm.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
But that's not enough, Tim. Dun, 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 dun. I was like Spider-Man. A man accused of breaking into a Mesa police department was sleeping in the ceiling, Tim. Mesa police officers and detectives arrived to work Wednesday to find a man who had been released from the Mesa holding facility just hours earlier sleeping in the ceiling of a third floor office. Jesus Ramon Carrillo Leiva, age 51, is facing charges of criminal trespassing and third-degree burglary, both of which are felonies and a misdemeanor criminal damage charge. It started at 7 a.m. when detectives who work on the third floor arrived at the main station building at 130 North Robson to start their day. Detectives found their workstations rummaged through, items misplaced, according to the court documents filed for Carrillo Leiva. Detectives began searching the office and found an office window had been broken from the outside, as glass pieces were on the office floor. Detectives also discovered an office in which somebody had gone through the desk and removed items from the drawer, Tim.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Hmm. About an hour later, officers arriving to start their shift spotted a hole that had been dug under the perimeter fence. They also found a backpack, ball cap, and a citation issued to Carrillo Leiva. The building was evacuated shortly after 10 p.m., so Mesa SWAT could search the building. While in the second office that had been rifled, SWAT officers noticed a ceiling tile that looked like it was out of place. SWAT officers checked the drop ceiling and observed the defendant sleeping in the ceiling, according to probable cause for arrest statement. Do you really need probable cause at that point? He's in your place, in your ceiling. Police said Carrillo Leva admitted to using drugs, that he had been arrested earlier and that he dug under the fence and then broke into the building because when he was released, he felt someone was going to harm him and he felt he would be safer if he was inside the building. It wasn't clear who or what he feared. He then explained that he climbed over the wall and located the extension ladder, court documents explained. The defendant stated he took the ladder, used it to climb each level of the building until he reached the third floor. The defendant stated, "I was like Spider-Man." Police said Carrillo Leva told them he searched several desks while looking for a phone to call his son. The defendant stated he climbed into the ceiling because he heard police officers arriving for work, according to court documents. Court documents show several arrests and convictions on drug charges, as well as trespassing and disorderly conduct and assault. Those documents also show that Carrillo Leva, I don't know why I have to say it and pause after it every time, Tim, failed to show up for court on at least two occasions.
That is, by the way, my favorite Lionel Richie song, Sleeping in the Ceiling. Yeah. It's one of my all-time favorites.
David Schwimmer is back in the news, Tim.
He is.
It only took a criminal that looked alarmingly like David Schwimmer to get him back in the news.
Huh.
Although Schwimmer has returned to TV as Grace Adler's curmudgeonly boyfriend in the new reboot of Will and Grace. October 25th. David Schwimmer posted on Twitter a comedic video of himself stealing from a grocery store in reference to a lookalike thief who's wanted by the British police. Blackpool police uploaded a security camera image on Wednesday of a man who's wanted for stealing from a restaurant. The image and story went viral as commentators quickly pointed out the thief resembled Schwimmer. "Officers, I swear it wasn't me. As you can see, I was in New York." To the hardworking Blackpool police, "Good luck with the investigation. Hashtag it wasn't me." The Friends alum said on Twitter Wednesday alongside the clip, Schwimmer reenacted the image of the lookalike thief by walking out of the grocery store with a crate full of beer. Oh, David Schwimmer, you are an American treasure.
Or an alcoholic, one or the other. I mean, if he...
Well, there's that. Beer, yeah. There's that, yeah. Tim. You know, you got to yell out spoiler alert when you're going to talk about movies and books and TV series, right?
Oh, yes.
You don't just talk about it.
Right.
Because when you do that kind of stuff, Tim.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that can happen to you. An Antarctic scientist stabbed a colleague who kept telling him endings of books he was reading.
Oh, gosh.
Avid readers Sergei Savitsky and Oleg Belagazov were based in a remote outpost in Antarctica when the alleged attack happened. A scientist plunged a kitchen knife into his colleague as he was fed up with the man telling him the endings of the books, says investigators. Sergei Savitsky and Oleg Belgazov would pass the lonely hours doing four harsh years together in a remote outpost in Antarctica by reading. However, Savitsky became angry after Belgazov kept telling him the endings.
Ooh.
Daily Record reports that the victim is now in intensive care with a knife injury to the heart. He was flown from Russia's Bellingshausen Research Station on King George Island to Chile following the alleged attack. I don't even, he doesn't even need Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law. You ruin the end of my books one after another. Somebody's got to die, Tim. Savitsky's back home in St. Petersburg under arrest. He's been charged with attempted murder. It is believed to be the first time a man has been charged with a murder in Antarctica. You got to be pretty pissed off to take a kitchen knife to somebody right then and there.
Is that justifiable assault?
It is, in my opinion, but really? I've been wrong before.
Hmm.
A man was arrested after falling asleep outside the scene of a burglary at a Limestone County motel, authorities said. Christopher Bright was taken into custody Friday because security video showed him break into a storage shed at the motel, according to the sheriff's office. Deputies were dispatched to the Budget Inn in Elkmont. A 911 caller reported finding a man passed out in a car outside the motel. Deputies found Bright inside the vehicle, which was parked in front of the storage shed, said Sheriff Spokesman Stephen Young. Security video shows Bright taking tools, clothes, and more from the shed, Young said. Those items were recovered from Bright's vehicle, according to deputies. Bright told investigators that he and his girlfriend were staying at the motel when they got into an argument. Bright went to the shed to find a gas can and gas, he told deputies. He stated that he was under the influence at the time and did not know why he had taken the other items from the shed, Young said in a release. Bright is a 30-year-old from Huntsville. He's held in the Limestone County Jail with a bail set at $2,500, Tim. Be worried about a guy who has a fight with his girlfriend and then decides the thing he needs next is gas. I could be wrong. A Washington state judge sprang into action and removed his robe to chase two handcuffed inmates attempting to flee his courtroom. Judge R.W. Buzzard leapt from his bench on October 16th when Tanner Jacobson and Cody Howard bolted from the Lewis County courtroom in Chehalis, about 85 miles southwest of Seattle. I'm sure I'm butchering that word. Chehalis. By the time they hit the door, I'm like, there's nobody between them and the street, Buzzard told Como News. So I wanted to at least find out where they were going. The inmates were being escorted from court by a sheriff's deputy, but just before the alleged attempted escape, instead of walking through an exit near the right side of the judge's bench, the suspects bolted for the door at the back of the courtroom, authorities said. Both men ran down four flights of stairs when Buzzard grabbed Howard as he was about to exit the courthouse through an emergency door, authorities say. Once I got to the stairwell, I knew I was going to be able to catch the one that was just in front of me because I immediately started gaining on him, Buzzard said. I was yelling at them all the way down the stairs to stop. You're making things worse. Jacobson was caught by authorities just a few blocks away. Both men have been charged with second-degree escape. Second degree? I mean, they straight up did it. Wouldn't that be first degree?
You would think.
Second degree would be like you get to the door and hit your head and fall backwards. Right?
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
These things don't happen very often, said Sheriff Rob Snassa. In April, what happened to the bailiff and like the other cops around the court? Why is Judge Judy jumping the bench and taking this into his hands?
I would pay good money for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found out that the grappling in a robe is very restrictive. He said, I couldn't imagine what running downstairs and being in a robe is. So I got it off as soon as I could and I went after them. Oh, it's an election year. That's why.
Ah, yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chehalis. I was right. It is Chehalis. But if I want to pronounce it as Chaka Waka Baka, they're not going to judge. That's what Matt Smith said when he sent me that story.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about chasing a suspect, Tim, a man chases a suspect on a lawnmower and helps police with the arrest. Lincoln, Nebraska, for this story. Lincoln police were able to track down a suspect who fled on foot after a citizen chased him down on a lawnmower and held him until officers arrived.
That is the slowest chase ever.
Oh, it is. LPD said on October 20th, shortly after 11 a.m., officers responded to a Wells Fargo. A bank manager reported a woman attempted to cash a $2,800 check in the drive-thru and was told she could only receive $1,000 cash back. The woman then asked for her check and ID back, and the teller and manager grew suspicious, police said. The bank manager was able to verify the woman was not who she said she was, and the purse she was in possession of was recently stolen. When an officer arrived, the woman accelerated out of the bank parking lot and did not stop for the officer. The driver lost control of the vehicle near 69th and Northridge Road, striking a curb and making it inoperable. Yeah, those Geo Metros are not the car to use for a police vehicle, Tim. Driver Deborah Gebris, 41, was arrested, but the passenger, 23-year-old DeAndre France, ran from the vehicle. Nebraska State Patrol's Air Wing was called to assist. Police said a citizen was able to chase France down on a lawnmower, caught up to him, and held him down until authorities arrived.
Oh, my.
France and Gebris were in possession of stolen identifications and checkbooks from various states. Gebris was arrested for second-degree forgery, and France was arrested for criminal possession of a transaction device. All right, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
In our final story, I've been holding out, but it's time to visit Florida.
I was just there.
I know. I got nervous when I saw the picture of this bald guy with a goatee.
Oh, my. Well, I didn't.
Oh, Tim.
I got away scot-free.
I guess. An arsenal of weapons found in a truck of a man passed out behind the wheel in Florida. Police said they could smell alcohol coming from the car, and the driver almost fell when they told him to get out of the vehicle, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
A stockpile of weapons, including loaded handguns and a semi-automatic rifle, was found in the back of a truck after Florida police found the driver passed out behind the wheel. David Goldhammer, 32, was arrested after officers found him unconscious in his pickup truck with his engine running and parked in front of an alley in Miami Beach around 1 a.m., on Thursday, police said they could smell alcohol coming from the car, and Goldhammer almost fell out of the vehicle when they told him to exit. Two open beer bottles were found in the truck, as well as two loaded handguns. He also had a gun in his waistband of his pants, police said. Officers ordered Goldhammer to perform a field sobriety test, but he refused and was taken into custody. A search of his vehicle turned up two more loaded handguns, a semi-automatic rifle, a pocket knife with a swastika on it, a bullet-resistant vest, and a large amount of ammunition. Jeez. Police have not said why Goldhammer from South Dakota had the stockpile in his car or what he was doing in the area. That's alarm. What's alarming in this case is that it's the early morning hours. It's Thursday morning. There's a man asleep at the wheel under the influence of an alcoholic beverage and an arsenal of weapons in his possession. Police spokesman Ernesto Rodriguez told NBC affiliate WTVJ, that's a deadly combination, and we need to understand why he was here in Miami Beach or South Florida, for that matter. Goldhammer was charged with DUI, openly carrying a weapon and carrying a concealed firearm. That's a lot of weapons and one big drunk dummy.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. I think they dodged a huge bullet, and no pun intended on that, but they stopped somebody I think might have been there to do some real damage.
Yeah.
We're going to Oakland, California for our final story. I lied, Tim. We had one more to go.
I see.
BART has had its fair share of stories of unusual moments on its trains, but one woman's tweet Monday prompted BART to respond. We've never seen anything like this before. The woman tweeted video to BART, which showed a man holding a chainsaw before opening another box that contained a second chainsaw. She tweeted, I had to film this just in case shit got sick. He kept calling himself the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then he said it was going to become the BART Massacre. BART responded by saying, we've never seen anything like this before. Best thing to do is snap a pic and send it to dispatch via BART Watch app. You can also go to another car and alert the train operator using intercom. What car are you on? They're very calm about this, right? Two chainsaws and the guy's promising a massacre. Huh, we've never seen that before. You might want to call and, I don't know, I might leave that car.
Yeah.
Very calm. BART reported police had received multiple calls about the incident and officers positioned themselves to board the train at Lake Merritt. When the man got off the train, the man identified as 47-year-old Patrick Bingman of San Francisco was taken into custody for having several outstanding arrest warrants and for making threats. He was booked into Alameda County Jail. According to BART, Bingman admitted to waving the chainsaws around but said he was just playing. The chainsaws were also stolen, according to police. According to BART spokeswoman Alicia Trost, the chainsaws were never activated. No one was injured. Additional details on the incident have not been released. Yeah, you might not want to joke around with chainsaws on a train.
Yeah.
I'm tired of these mother peeping chainsaws on this mother beeping train.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Way to go. But this is a good way to go. We are done for today. Thank you all for tuning in and being part of our world. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. That's Tim. I'm Dave, and this is True Crime Tuesday.